Good evening, everyone. And so I'm back today, obviously. And then next week I'm gone again. Gone, going and coming is the name of the summer. Next week, Paul Howler is going to come and give the talk. And Paul is... Well, so one of the ways that insight meditation benefits us, this is both the good news and the bad news of insight meditation, is that the wisdom that comes from this kind of practice often comes through familiarity. And it's good news in that as we become more familiar with our inner reactions, our responses, the way our mind works and our heart works, and the ways that desire pull us away out of the present moment, or aversion kind of gets us caught up, and our impatience and all the various things that cause stress in our lives. So we become more familiar with them, more and more familiar we are with them, the often the less power they have. You get to know them so well, you kind of see them coming, and you reckon, oh, there they are again, and you're not fooled by them anymore. You've seen desire or aversion arise so many times that, oh, there's my old friend. So you don't, oh, I don't have to believe that impulse. I can just watch it. Or if I act on that impulse, I know, I've noticed that if I, you know, that I keep just digging my own grave whenever I speak from my aversion. So we then made so many mistakes in our lives that we finally learn, oh, we learn from, you know, we learn from the familiarity. We learn, oh, I'm not going to do that again, or I don't have to do that. And the bad news of that is, of course, that familiarity means you have to see it over and over and over and over again. And many of us get impatient. We want a quick fix. We want a quick solution. And the idea that maybe it just takes seeing things over and over and over again that is what's going to set us free is, you know, bad news. However, I think very often insight meditation works that way, is that, unfortunately for many of us might think, is that you really have to become familiar with what's going on inside. And sometimes as a teacher, I have the feeling that, you know, people come to me, sometimes they come and present something, a problem in their lives, and what they want is hopefully my wisdom or whatever, and tell them, this is what you do, do X, Y, and Z, and you won't have that problem anymore. And if I simply said to them, the X, Y, and Z you have to do is just keep doing it and notice that you do it. And after you've done it 1,000 times and notice yourself doing the same stupid thing 1,000 times, then you'll catch it and notice, and then you'll be free. I mean, they're not going to come back that often. Well, thanks. That's your wisdom? But, you know, that's the way it often works. I mean, that's the, you know, the you'll find through your own experience, I think, that a lot of things that you're struggling with and working with, that just the familiarity with them over and over again will give you some certain amount of freedom and ease and detachment from them. When my early years of practice, I had a lot of guilt. It was kind of a very common theme, just guilt and shame just came up in all kinds of ways, in the silliest ways possible. The way I'd walk across the meditation hall floor was just, I felt like I was doing it all wrong. I was guilty of some major crime. And so, I for some reason, I had no idea that I was supposed to practice with that or work with it and do anything about it or fix it. It was always there. Maybe I kind of thought it was true. So just, so I saw it over and over and over again. And slowly, as I kept seeing it over and over again, it's kind of like two things happened. On one hand, I gave it permission to be there. And so I wasn't reacting to it. I wasn't buying into it. It just was there. And then I saw the pattern over and over and over again. And so slowly, the grip and the attachment and the fear and all the attitudes I had towards it started loosening up more and more. And it's finally, I just would see it and I could smile. Oh, there's that guilt again. Wow. You know, and there's a big difference between, oh my God, the guilt, and, oh, there it is again. Oh. And the latter is, you know, it's kind of free of it. And so some of the freedom that can come from insight meditation is the freedom not of being free of that thing, free from that thing. The thing doesn't exist, the problem doesn't arise. But you know, the freedom comes from, so the freedom is not its absence, but the freedom is rather that you see it so clearly, you're no longer so caught by the drama of it or the story of it and everything. And what I'm saying tonight so far is that part of that freedom comes from familiarity. So that's a call for that. What we need to do in mindfulness practice is to recognize what's happening in the present moment. And it's the recognition that gives familiarity. If we sit here and have some drama of desire arise in our sitting, desire for a better sitting, a better, you know, whatever, a better evening, a better movie, a better personal biography, a better fantasy, a better, you know, we want all these things. And we don't see the tremendous ways in which we get sucked up and seduced in the wanting mind. And the wanting mind actually gets reinforced, and you're more likely to fall into that wanting mind again. But if you can see, oh, what's happening right now is I want. I'm full of desire and wanting things, rather than just relaxing, just being present for how things are. My wanting is so powerful. I'm so caught up in it. I don't even recognize that I'm wanting. And what we want to do in mindfulness practice is simply to see, oh, I'm wanting. And you can certainly do a lot of practice investigating that and getting to know it better. But there's tremendous power in seeing that over and over and over again. That each time you see it honestly and clearly, you very subtly extract yourself from it. And as the story goes, you can fill up a bathtub with drops. It takes a long time. But we fill up a bathtub of freedom with each drop of freedom we bring to it. And it might not feel very significant in one simple little moment of recognizing your wanting mind. But you do that enough times, and it fills the bathtub of freedom. If you don't do that, you might think it's very innocent, you know, simply getting lost in my fantasy of desire. You might think that's very innocent. You know, it was a nice desire after all. It's not harming anyone, and I was actually bringing them a lot of pleasure too. You know, what's the harm in that, in this fantasy? The same principles applies. That drop by drop are prison. We create our own prison. We create our own tremendous habits of reactivity and habits of being lost. And, you know, one innocent moment translated 10, 50,000 times is quite consequential. So the wisdom of familiarity, the wisdom of simply allowing yourself to see things over and over and over again. And sometimes my advice to people is simply, so people come and tell me certain things about what's going on with them, and my advice is simply, you know, just keep noticing it. Be sure to notice that when it arises. Get to know it better. Maybe explore it a little bit more carefully. Get to know it better, rather than my kind of saying, "Oh, that's the solution," you know. So, oh, maybe next time you come and talk to me, maybe you can tell me something new, what you discovered about that particular constant repetition of desire, or constant repetition of a judgment that you might have. Notice something new about it. Notice what happens in your body when you have those kinds of momentums. What happens in your body? What happens in your feelings? What happens in your speech and the way you talk to people? Notice something new about it. Maybe make it interesting, make it kind of a game of, you know, how many things can I notice about being judgmental? You know, they're all, you know, kind of look at it from new perspectives. What are the different emotions that seem to come into play when I'm being really judgmental? What are all the various body sensations? What happens to the way my eyes work and I see the world around me when each time I'm judged? Is it, I don't know if you've noticed this, but there's a way sometimes that our vision, it's kind of almost like it gets darker or more constricted or narrower when we get caught up in certain emotions and moods and feelings and judgments, for example. And if you're sensitive, you can feel the narrowing of that field. It's like our field gets narrower. And you can sometimes contrast that with a really wide field of awareness when you feel like you're aware of things from a very open heart. You feel like the heart is very tender, very open, and your relationship to the world is kind of from your whole chest area. You're kind of there, kind of relaxed and open, just kind of feeling it all, kind of taking it all in. And then then suddenly a judgment arises, and certainly that's no longer here, but the openness is not in here, but rather this, you know, things get kind of closed. So the familiarity, you know, not trying to fix things or look for solutions, but simply just get to know it better. Over and over and over again, familiarity. There are some Vipassana teachers who will give their students the assignment of counting how many times certain things arise for them. Count how many times you're judgmental in a day. Count how many times you have a desire, a thought, you want something. Or, you know, count certain how many times you have doubt arise in your mind. And there's a number of things that might happen if you do that kind of assignment. One is a person gets really familiar how often it is. And it's really sobering to see, you know, I judge people 332 times so far today, and I haven't gotten out of bed yet. You know, it's 10 o'clock in the morning or whatever. You know, I had no idea it was that degree. And that degree of familiarity is a wake-up call. Wow, I had no idea it was like that. I kind of had some sense that I was judgmental. I thought I was kind of in the normal range of how people are judgmental, but am I really normal when I get to 600 by the afternoon? And you don't really know until you count. You say, wow, you know, I'm really doing it a lot. And if you're the lucky sort of person, when you get to 920 or something, then you finally smile. Finally you laugh. This is ridiculous. And then hopefully you bring a sense of humor. Having some humor about what's going on inside of you is really helpful when your practice is the practice of familiarity. Oh, here it is again. Haka, I've done that again. Occasionally with my wife sometimes, but now with child rearing, we kind of look at each other and say, guess what? We did it again. And that helps a lot. So the wisdom of familiarity. So what is it we become familiar with in our lives? What are some of the common themes? One of the common themes that's been in my mind today is I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about is desire itself. It's very freeing. A tremendous amount of wisdom comes from just recognizing how desire works in our lives. And it's a very important subject. A lot of suffering in our life arises from our desires and the desires of others. And there are some people who are very quick to defend their desires. I was actually disturbed by one of the few speeches I heard at a recent, very recent, current political convention. It's kind of hard to avoid naming which one, when there's only been one so far. And it wasn't to raise questions about the politics, but the one person that came up and spoke was speaking from their own particular life. It seems like this current political convention wants to use a lot of personal anecdotes to kind of be justification for platforms. So a person was speaking very kind of from the heart. It was very, it's kind of nice to hear in a sense, but it disturbed me tremendously to hear this woman talk, because she was justifying political policy based on what she felt she deserved. And the whole discussion about what she deserved, I didn't hear any kind of feeling of part of what she deserves to have, or what any person deserves to have or needs to have, is a sense of responsibility towards others, the common good, and how we as individuals relate to the society around us. And it was all from the point of view of what I need and what I can get. And this particular political platform is going to help me get what I feel I need to get and what I deserve to get. And I don't begrudge a person some of those attitudes, but I feel that they should be in balance with some other attitudes about life. When I was the radical leftist, hippie, fundamentalist hippie. Actually, I don't know. Maybe I was a conservative hippie. You know, there was a left wing and a right wing, right? And I was the right wing of the right wing, hardcore right wing of the leftists. You know. And I was living on communes and around the country, and my great ideal was to, you know, go off in the country and be self-supporting and kind of check out of the exploitive economic system that our country's in, and just didn't seem to be any solution to it except to provide a model of how to have a whole different way relationship to the, to land and to the economy and taking care of oneself. And the ideal, some of you, maybe some of you lived it, that ideal also back then, was go back to the land, become self-sufficient. Some people had this beautiful ideal of that. And so that was a certain hippie idealism that I lived in. And then I went back to Norway, where I was born. And so I went to look for communes there. What else do you do? So I went and found Norwegian communes. People had gone back to the land, living on the land there, and farms there. And I would tell them my ideals of self-sufficiency. And they were horrified. All my hippie friends in America thought that was great. But my Norwegian hippie friends who were living on farms, they were horrified by this. And they said, wait a minute. What about your sense of responsibility to society? To be self-sufficient means that you're not... You know, the idea was just to grow food for yourself, right? But their idea was you grow food, but part of what you do is you grow food so you can feed the people in the city. You know, and you try to have the small-scale farming and do it organically and do all these wonderful things. But you're doing it because you feel connected also to your society that you're part of. And so there's important, you know, so your sense of personal response, your social responsibility is infused with this idea of being, you know, to going back to the nature and whatever, 30 years ago. So desire, the whole point I'm trying to say is that the subject of desire for many people will lead them very quickly to want to defend their desire, but somehow they're justified in the desire. It's okay for me to have my desires. And we have a culture which supports that. We have a culture that, you know, the advertisement industry is built on trying to get the message across that your desire for this particular commodity is worthwhile. You should want it. You should deserve to have it. You need to have it. It's required that you have it. How can you get by in life without it? And so to the degree to which we're bombarded by mass media and commercials and advertisements, but these things kind of enter our skin by osmosis. The desire, desire, desire. We want, we want, we want. And I know from my own personal experience that it's possible to go through a long chunk of the day kind of, you know, filled with desire thoughts. I want that, I would like that. It would be nice to have that, wouldn't it? And I find for myself that if I'm relatively comfortable with my life, things are basically going pretty well, I'm pretty content and pretty nice, but I'm not paying particularly a lot of attention, that's when I'm most likely to be caught up in desires, wanting things a lot, goods, things. I look, you know, driving along, I'm comfortable, I'm driving my little old Toyota, and I see this nice car next to me. Oh, it'd be nice to have that car. And then I say, look, well, you know, maybe Dharma teachers shouldn't be driving around in Mercedeses, so maybe that's not, you know, so I look around, well, you know, that's a nice car too, a BMW. You know, but you know, I can't really afford a BMW, so okay, what else do I want? Well, and here I'm going, innocently going, filled with this, I want desire thought after another about cars or, you know, or cell phones, you know. It's easy to have cell phone desires for some of us. Someone today told me they had desired a cell phone. She said, oh, I want them because they're so cute. I don't really need a cell phone, but they're so cute. I'd like to have one.
I thought you had one.
Oh, I have one. I have it in my pocket. Oh. Mine is not particularly cute, but... But it's one thing to have one, but then you want, you know, the updates. A better one or a cuter one. Or you want the one that kind of lets you have email. Or you want the one that does music. Or you want the one, you know, it's wanting is really easy. Some of us. Not some people are the desire type. I think I'm more the desire type. So, yes?
You know, one of the things I learned back in sales training in a previous life was you had to convert your prospects from a person who needed something to a person who wanted something. And so you had...
Shouldn't it be the other way around?
No, it was was, I'm not sure which way, but the idea was it had to get to the level of really desiring something greater than simply just really wanting it. Maybe it was maybe the other way around.
Yeah.
It was the idea of really getting this need. So you got them saying, I need your product, and you really weren't going to be more successful as a salesperson, and, you know, because they could obviously dismiss it as just something they wanted. But wanting alone was not enough. It was a matter of needing it.
Yeah. I think they must be trained to do this. I've told this story to some of you before, but when I went to buy, four years ago, I went to check out new cars. So I went over a new car. So the new car salesman was next to me in the car. We went for a test drive, right? And he said, you should get an air conditioning. And I said, I don't know if I need an air conditioning. I never had one before, and you know, I think I can do without it. And I said, everything changes. And those of you who know enough about Buddhism knows that that's, you know, got my attention. The basic tenet of Buddhism is everything changes, right? There's a car salesman tells me this great, great, great piece of, you know, spiritual wisdom. And you know what the conclusion of that was? The conclusion of everything changes is you deserve an air conditioning. That's what he said. Everything changes. You deserve an air conditioning. I didn't quite see the connection, but you deserve means, oh, I need it. So desire. It's very easy to be to be filled with a desire, and it's very easy to believe the desires. And a lot of the little desires can be innocent. I'm not in the danger of getting a new cell phone, but it's very easy for me still to have ideas about, oh, it'd be nice to have that cell phone and that cell phone. And walk by the cell phone store and, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have that? I'd like to have that. So, you know, I have some familiarity with my desire mind. So I can kind of, you know, I can have desires and just, you know, I can walk by the store and desire it for a moment and then it's forgotten. So I can be pretty free of desires. And hopefully that's what we're trying to learn here, is to see really clearly these tendencies of the mind and see it, maybe even smile at it and laugh at it, but not to be sucked up into it and kind of get lost in this track of desire, get lost in this great wasteland, this great maze of endless desiring. Because one of the things that desire does, if it's too incessant, too fills us too much of the time, is it really alienates us from ourselves. In a very simple way, that if you're always focusing on the objects of what you want, you're not really focusing on what's going on, how you really feel, what's going on inside of you, what your own thoughts are, what your desires are even. You don't even notice them. And it's very easy in our society to get alienated from ourselves, to lose touch with ourselves. Or to only be in touch with ourselves to the degree we know we're stressed out. And so I think what I want then is, what I need to do is I want more things to soothe me. And so feeling stressed out is just another prompt to want more things. And then we want more things, and we get soothed temporarily perhaps from our fantasies or actually getting the things we want. But it actually causes us to be ever so slightly more alienated. And it's very important in a spiritual life or in a sane life to recognize the difference between relief and freedom, or the difference between being soothed versus being set free or being at home or being deeply contented. So if we feel off in some ways or stressed out, and then we go look for how to soothe ourselves, and we do that repeatedly, and we don't realize what we're doing is soothing ourselves, we might actually be shortchanging ourselves from deeper possibilities. And meditation, hopefully, is the place where you're not doing meditation to soothe yourself. You're doing meditation to really enter into what's really happening for you. Meditation is meant to be a moment of truth-telling, a moment of accountability, hopefully more than just a moment. You know, a period of accountability, a period of truth-telling, a period of recognizing, oh, this is what's really going on with me. And I don't like what's going on with me, but I'm going to hang out with it and get familiar with it. I'm going to be present for it. I'm not going to run to the refrigerator. I'm not going to run to the movies or the television or soothe it in some way. Even if it's uncomfortable, I'm going to get to know it. And if desire is running your life, to stop and be honest and accountable to your desiring, you might actually find out how uncomfortable it is. If you're lost in the desire, it can actually be somewhat pleasant. But if you stop and feel where the momentum is coming from for desiring, you might feel it comes from tension, from stress. You might feel how it's actually tensing to have those kinds of momentum in your body. And you might notice that underneath that there might be loneliness, insecurity, fear. That's kind of really sometimes the momentum, the impetus to have desire. Desire sometimes is a symptom of trying to look for relief. Look for something to soothe you by. So desire. So part of the task of mindfulness then is to get to recognize a desire when they arise, to count them, to feel them, to see them. To feel how they maybe might separate them from ourselves. From ourselves. One of the great lessons of my life was before I was doing actually any serious meditation practice, was discovering the joy of unrequited love. How many of you have discovered this? Not very many of you. I recommend it to you. If you haven't discovered this by this time in your life, you should make it your homework. Your life will be a lot happier if you discover the joy of unrequited love. Most people suffer, right? Unrequited love. And how it works is that what happened was that I'd fallen in love with a couple of people. I was in college. It was right near the end of the school year. And there might have been possibilities pursuing these things. However, I left for the summer. And I spent a lot of that summer out in nature. A lot of very kind of somewhat solitary times, a lot of solitary times in nature, at least. And I decided that summer that it was okay to let it was okay to have fantasy. There was nothing wrong with having fantasy. I just give free rein to my fantasy and let it do what it wants. When I had these hours at a time, just kind of under the night sky, just looking at the stars. And I noticed, so I had some feelings of love and desire and for these people arose. And I noticed that after a while, I noticed that when I thought about these people, that it made me kind of warm and happy. And there was kind of joy, kind of knowing that they existed in the world made me kind of happy. What I was attracted to in these people was kind of this kind of spark of some beauty in those people. And there was this real appreciation of that beauty. And because I had all the summer to kind of hang out with it, and my fantasy and all that, slowly I saw that actually my desire to have a relationship with them, a desire to get something from them, a desire for them to love me back or whatever, was different than my simple, beautiful appreciation of that person as that person was. The inspiration and delight that was born inside of me when I thought of that person or saw that person was actually quite different from my desire to whatever, you know. There's many, many desires we can have, right? Relationship to another person, right? So I saw those two are different. And that was so important for me to see that my desire for the person, my desire for relationship, my desire for whatever, was distinct from my joy in knowing that person, seeing that person, feeling that person's presence. And since that time, then, I've been able to often then make that distinction in my relationship with people. And I've been able to have the joy of unrequited love. I can now, it's much easier for me. Since that time, it was a lot easier for me just to appreciate someone and appreciate my feelings that bubbled up inside of me in relationship to that person. The feelings of love are beautiful feelings. And the beautiful thing is to realize that love and desire are two different things. They may be closely connected. They're kind of like siblings or something, or whatever. But they're not the same thing. But most people have the two completely confused. Or at least they don't see the difference between the two. And so they think that in order to love, they have to have desire. And since the desire is connected to love, they have to have the object of desire, the person that they love. But if you realize the two are different, then it's possible to have the love and have your own delight and joy and kind of bubbly feelings and whatever delight that happens inside of you and appreciate those without needing to follow through on the desire that seems to, you know, that sometimes comes along with it. Does that make some sense? It was tremendously helpful for me in my life. So if you haven't figured this one out yet, I would encourage you to discover the joy of unrequited love. And I'm sure there's opportunities. People are nice. There's lots of nice people in the world, lots and lots of them. And even if you and maybe you think, well, I'm married. Maybe some of you are married. You know, married people can have fall in love with other people. That's okay. I think there's nothing immoral about married people falling in love with other people besides their spouse. But then it's really good to know about the joy of unrequited love. You know, nothing has to happen. You say, wow, that's a great person. I feel, you know, it's really nice and nice feelings I have and nice feel that person's great and I appreciate that person. But if you don't have, but if you haven't studied your desire and seen it clearly and learned how to be a little bit independent of your desire, it's hard to have this particular kind of joy. So part of what we're trying to learn in mindfulness is how to be independent of our desire. And I think it's an idea which is really foreign to people, many people in our society, because there are people in our society who really, they don't see a difference between who they are, their true essence as a soul, as a being, and their desire. But the desire is actually superfluous to who we actually are in our deepest sense. So to realize that, and then by realizing that, become independent of your desire, gives a person a tremendous freedom in their life and a lot of confidence and power. So to have this, a lot of this is then become familiar with desire. Take it up as a subject of study. Get interested in it. Make it your homework assignment for the next year, for the next lifetime, and for the next week at least. You know, notice desires. Notice when you have desires. Notice how often they are. Talk to your friends about your desires. You know, tell them, you know, it's my homework assignment this week to study desires. Can I tell you about all the desires I had? Maybe you'll tell me your desires. Let's share desire stories. I had this desire and I didn't notice it until after I bought that, and you fill in the blank. You know, wow, I didn't know that I could notice something after the fact. Or I said something. Yeah, please.
You're talking a lot about material desires, which for me are pretty easy to identify. What I'm finding much more stumped are the things that disguise themselves and don't appear as desires that take me a long time to figure out. Like, I wanted something, a meeting to go a particular way in business, or you know, want my kids to act a particular way, or get frustrated that this isn't, you know, that is the part maybe you could talk about a little bit more of other things that disguise, desire that disguises itself as something else.
Yeah, I mean this is what we start paying attention to desire, and it's epidemic. I mean, it's in all kinds of areas in our life. And the example I was going to talk more about was meditation itself, how it plays out in meditation. And meditation is a little bit like a microcosm of what happens the rest of our life. Because you see, not only do we see in meditation how powerful desires are working, we start thinking about our children, we start thinking about the meeting, and you start seeing, wow, I really have a big agenda here. I have desires and wants here. Or maybe you don't see them until you see the frustration. And sometimes frustration in these kinds of situations is the clearest indication that you have desire. And maybe you need to pay attention to it. So in meditation, sometimes it's a really effective place to start noticing where our tendencies are. But also in relationship to meditation itself, we have desires, you know, for a better sitting. We have desire for that the knee treats itself. You know, we have, I wish I had different knees. You know, or I desire, there's no endless desires you can have in relationship to meditation. So they're certainly outside of material things. So you want me to say something wise, useful.
You already did.
About kids.
Meditation, because you just go through when you to be aware of how that happens in meditation of a desire of not having this pain or a desire.
Well, yeah, so meditation is a phenomenally effective place because it's a microcosm. And this is the time you're going to actually, you're training yourself to pay particularly careful attention to what's going on. And so you start noticing the degree to how your mind works in meditation. And that'll translate directly into your daily life. And my early years of my first couple of years of practice, I had no idea that you're supposed to be mindful in daily life. I thought spiritual practice was only what you did on the cushion, for the most part. And so I was a very good sitter. I sat regularly, And but then after a while, it's like all this insight was happening. It's like this pressure was building to burst beyond the confines of my sitting. And soon enough, I realized how artificial the barrier was between sitting and outside. But the familiarity of what was going on in my sitting then translated eventually directly to becoming familiar with the same tendencies in my daily life. What's interesting about non-material things, perhaps, is that, like relationships, is that sometimes it speaks much more deeply to our self-identity. Much more deeply rooted places of our self-identity. And sometimes the desires, the relationship to material things are actually, if you actually study that desire more carefully, you might see that underneath that is a deeper desire, a desire of how you want to be seen by other people. And so the question is, how do you, so in meetings, for example, with for some people with a relationship to children, it's not so much, their desires have a lot to do with how you want to be seen. By the children or by your neighbors, for example. Sometimes it's desires for comfort. Sometimes it's desires that arise out of anticipation of what the future is going to be like. You know, if I don't get this out of my children now, what are they going to be like when they're 20? You know, whatever. So, I'm just kind of talking. I don't have any clear response to you. Your question is great. For me to elucidate. Yes?
My question is, when you identify desire coming up, say you wanted to buy something and you're in the process of buying that and you realize, oh well, I intend to buy this in order to get over some discomfort. I might wonder, oh, should I buy this then or should I not buy this? Say, something small, even just a piece of candy or something.
So the question is, if you see a desire, and you see the desire as an attempt to kind of soothe yourself, kind of,
mm-hmm.
And then the question is, once you see that, should you go ahead and soothe yourself or not?
Right. If you don't want to... you say the purpose isn't to change, but just to notice. You just notice it and continue.
Well, the purpose isn't necessarily... The ultimate purpose of practice is to change. But the strategy sometimes is of how to get... The most effective way to create change is not to try to make it happen. So it's a little bit of a paradox, right? The spirit of mindfulness practice, or the way I like it to practice it, is one of trial and error. So you notice this, and then you try one way and try a different way another time, and you pay attention to the consequences. You might find that by giving in to buying a little trinket or a little candy bar or whatever and soothe yourself, that it actually doesn't help you. It's kind of a temporary relief, but it actually just puts off the inevitable you have to face. Or it might actually give you an indigestion. Maybe spiritual indigestion. It might habituate yourself. It might find that it actually makes it a little bit easier next time to give in to that little impulse. It's like having an itch You itch it, you scratch it more and more, and the more you scratch it, the more you want to scratch it. That it becomes, it was quite innocent the first three times, but it seems like it habituates you to do it more often. You might find that if you, with the times you try not to give it, you don't buy that little trinket, or you don't buy that candy bar or whatever. You might find that it makes you a little bit uncomfortable, but by the time you hang out with the discomfort, and actually feel a bit lighter when it's finished. Rather than feeling kind of a little bit heavier, or a little bit soother, or a little bit duller, you actually feel a bit lighter and more alert because you didn't give into it and you hung out there. And maybe say, well, maybe what I'll do is, rather than buying the candy bar or whatever to soothe myself, maybe what I'll do, maybe this is an indication, I really need some help here. I really am stressed. The fact that I want the candy bar means that there's actually a problem here. Is there a better way to address the problem? Oh, maybe there is. Maybe what I really need to do is to go back and talk to my boss and say, you know, there's a problem here at work. I'm being given too much work. It's, you know, I'm getting stressed. I think I need some help. Or, you know, or a whole, you know, infinite number of scenarios where, or maybe that what you realize you need is, what I need to do is to sit and be still for 5 minutes and really be honest and really explore what's really going on here. Maybe I don't really know what's happening here. So the spirit is spirit of trial and error. And in doing trial and error, to pay very careful attention to the consequences and then learn from that. And one of the ways we learn is we learn from our mistakes. Maybe it's been said too many times, it's a cliche. Good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So to try it, try different ways. I'm a great believer in trial and error. Yeah.
But back to his question, it seems to me that sometimes you go ahead and buy the candy bar and you eat it and it just tastes great and it's fine and you just go about your business. It's not. I mean, don't you agree that sometimes it's. Yeah. It's not to soothe something. It's not, doesn't have a hidden agenda. It's just a.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's quite possible.
It's easily possible. I have no trouble with people eating candy bars in and of itself. I mean, enjoy it. I mean, I don't want to take away the joy. But hopefully, if you're mindful, you'll know that's what the case. Wow, that was great. Not only was it a great candy bar, there was no particular neurotic desire connected to it. Yes.
Speaking of neurotic desire. Do you know anything about this little twist on it? Because what I know about my desire is that desire and deserve are connected in my mind. And if I've been spending a lot of time trying to get more allied with my own intuition, and so if I, and I've also spent a lot of part of my life believing I don't deserve anything, and so when I am able to turn the corner and come to believe that I do deserve something, then it seems to me like it has this magic attached to it. Oh, this must be my intuition telling me that I must have this now. And it has this big charge, neurotic charge attached to it. And that becomes very difficult to resist. And fortunately, these desires I can't really put into action because they require someone else to participate, so...
Even though you deserve them.
So I kind of, when you, yeah. I mean, to propose a year of studying the nature of desire with the goal of becoming free of it, it's what a concept. I would love to be free of my desire. It's taken me over. I'm not, it is me.
Thank you. This is really important that you mention this and talk about it. And this is why I spent so much time at the beginning talking about the value of familiarity. It means you have to have some patience with it, and you know, really it takes time. Sometimes a quick fix is not necessarily the call. Sometimes you might see some key that really transforms it very quickly. But you know, and I think it's healthier to look at it that you're going to get in the trenches with it and study it. And so a few things I could say. One is. I'll start by saying this, that meditation, regular dedicated meditation practice, is a phenomenally powerful influence on a person's life. And one of the things you'll learn through meditation practice, at least during that period of time that you're meditating every day, you don't need anything. It's not a matter of deserving or not deserving. It's simply you don't need. Your well-being, your peace, is not dependent on what you think you need. It's possible to discover a happiness, a well-being, a peace that is completely independent of any other person, any other needs, any other results in the world. It's possible to have it now free of anything at all in the 40 minutes you're sitting every morning. If you have that as a reference point, that you can get, if you can get kind of to zero in meditation, you discover a peace that's not dependent on anything. Are you with me still? Yeah? If you can get that, find that peace in that you're sitting at least, that becomes a phenomenally powerful reference point for the other desires and deserves outside of that. You get a perspective that to really help accelerate this process of seeing what's going on and seeing where the line is between desire and deserve. One of the things you might start seeing also is one of the advantages of very powerful concentrated sitting is it takes us out of, hopefully, you are reacting to the message you got, you don't deserve, which is a terrible message, oppressive message that people get. But the obvious logical thing to do then is to go the other direction, the other side of that, say, well, that means I deserve. I need to counter the message I don't deserve with a stronger message saying I deserve. And so it's a lot of effort. And what you might be able to discover through, for example, like meditation or some other thing, is you don't have to participate in either of those games. The freedom to be free of the message I don't deserve doesn't require the opposite message. To be free of not deserving means that maybe you don't deserve it. Maybe there's a desire. Maybe there's a wish. Maybe there's even a need. Maybe there's a strong impulse or whatever. But it's not being tied into that game, a desire of deserve and not deserve. And maybe you don't deserve it at all. Maybe no one deserves what you want. Maybe there's no deserves at all in the world. Maybe no one in the world deserves anything at all. It's possible. I mean, this is a radical thing to say in America. I probably get lynched. Especially, yeah. But it's, you know, what is it possible that human beings were not constructed to deserve anything? That doesn't mean that it's not appropriate to pursue things. But we don't pursue it without... I think it's a kind of a burden that you deserve. But I should be careful, of course, because deserving also fits certain contexts. And I think part of getting wise around what we deserve is to understand the context that we're in. If you're in a work situation and they're promising you, if you do this kind of performance, then you're going to, you know, we're going to promise you this kind of result. Then, of course, you fulfill your end of the bargain, and they don't fulfill their end of the bargain. Then you deserve something that's not being returned. So, in that context, I think, you know, contextually, you have to study the context too. So, I went on for quite a while, but did this address your concern?
Very much.
I'm very grateful to what I've learned through meditation, to learn this zero point where you don't need anything. So all of us need to not need anything for about 5 minutes now. So thank you all, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks. I hope you have a wonderfully happy 2 weeks discovering the joys of unrequited love and the joys of independence from your desires and the joy of laughing at yourself. And I hope you all come back next week, because Paul, who will be speaking, is a real treat to have him here to talk to you. Thank you.